Hello, this is Glumpuddle. Last week, it was officially announced that Netflix is indeed developing new Narnia adaptations, but the discussion you are about to hear was recorded before that news was posted. And you will notice that the quality of my audio during this discussion is not good because I had a problem with my microphone. Sorry about that. But before a new era of Narnia adaptations begins, let's take a look back.
Welcome to Talking Beasts
from NarniaWeb.com,
where we explore the world of C.S. Lewis
and keep a watchful eye
on the latest Narnia movie news.
This
is Talking Beasts.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back. I'm your host, Rillian.
And I'm Jim Fan.
I'm Glumpuddle.
Here to talk about something that we've actually gotten a lot of requests about, because we do listen to feedback, and folks have said, hey, you guys need to talk about the Walden Media Narnia movies, but they did have a lot that was good about them. And sometimes I think we are a little bit overly critical.
Especially with the Silver Tear coming out, I think it, or so we thought, or so we still could be. So with some kind of new Narnia adaptation in the works, it makes sense that we would kind of focus on, oh, I hope they do this better. But yeah, as a result, even though we overall like at least the first two Walden movies, you might not necessarily know that just from listening to us the past couple seasons. We've been the bad we've kind of emphasized. That's a very valid criticism.
And then the Walden Narnia movies are special. I mean, NarniaWeb.com owes a lot to its own existence, really, to the Narnia movies coming out.
Mm-hmm.
And
we owe our friendship to it.
That's true.
But and of course we're gonna nitpick, but it's kind of like, and especially it's interesting gaining distance from the films a little bit as time has gone on, because now they're kind of like, people, I could actually truthfully reference them as the old Narnia movies, which is kind of crazy. But the thing is that when you look at all the book adaptations that have ever come out and been adapted into movies, and even recent ones, I didn't see A Wrinkle in Time. I actually planned to, because I just recently read the book, and I thought, okay, I'm gonna watch this movie. But you know, it really, there's a lot of good stuff in the Walden movies, and we're gonna talk about that tonight.
So say no hating on the Walden as of now. Okay, a no hating zone on the Walden movies. We've done plenty of that. This is just gushing.
Just gushing on the Walden movies. And While this is going on, we're going to give Jim Fan something to think about in the back of her mind that she can ponder as we're discussing the wonderfulness of the Walden movies.
At the end of this episode, you are going to be getting Stumped Jim Fan, possibly.
I have a zero success track record with these, so we'll see how it goes.
Okay. Well, anyway, so your question is, in the Chronicles of Narnia movies, stuntman Shane Rainey is credited with 4 roles. Can you name those 4 roles? And it's a tricky one because it's credited. It wasn't credited for all the roles he played. So a little guesswork there.
I might know this one. Maybe.
We'll get to that in about however long it takes us to discuss. Could be 30 minutes, hour and a half. We'll see.
Yeah, but
we'll come back to that.
So, hang on, I'm going to go Google this real fast.
No, you're not.
I won't, I promise.
Obviously when we're discussing films, it's a big challenge, and it's a unique challenge, adapting a book to a movie. And we did a quick little, not really a poll, but just asking people in the Talking Beast Facebook group, hey, what are just some of your favorite things about the Walden movies? Things that they absolutely got right. You know, a lot of people mentioned the soundtrack. Edson Falcon mentioned, the soundtrack and just the battle scenes. And, that was a big thing, the set design and production design. That, Jenilyn Barton basically said the production design, attention to detail, the actors and the soundtrack.
Yeah, definitely a big theme. He seems to be, the music and just the overall look and feel of it, I think people are given a lot of praise for. In the one that we did, actually, people were really impressed with it technically, and that Narnia feels real, I think, is what people seem to like the most about it.
A lot of people mentioned the battles And which is kind of interesting because, of course, they don't get quite the same attention in the books. But with this, all this stuff in mind, we could go on and on and on. But I just kind of want to try to focus. And Jim Fan, since you're getting stumped, it's only fair, I guess, we start with you. Jim Fan, what are two things within the Walden films? And it could be something that, like an actor that spans the films, or it could be something unique to one film. What are two things that you thought, man, they just nailed it?
Well, I should probably preface this by saying, and I've said this before, that for me personally, Prince Caspian is one of my probably top 10 favorite films. Like, there is just so much
ever?
About the overall package. Yes, ever.
Wow. And I don't think you've ever said that.
I think I have said that.
Maybe.
but there's just something about the overall package, like the overall execution. And yes, there are little things in it that are problematic, nitpicky or whatever. But as far as like the overall package, like the directing and the vision and the technical aspects, like the cinematography, the acting, the music, different things like that, the way it all came together. Even when I sit down today and I rewatch this movie, like even when we were rewatching it a little while back for the 10th anniversary, like I'm just struck by how much I just love the overall effect of that film and how they took a book that is probably my least favorite book and turned it into one of my most favorite movies. And I think maybe it's kind of the contrast between the two, like how it was like a challenge. You know, they took something that I always knew was going to be a challenge to adapt and turned it into something that I think works cinematically. It works as a film. Now, are there issues with the adaptation? Yes. But as far as it being a cinematic film, I love the package. But if I was going to isolate two specific components within the Walden films as a whole, I would say the first one for me would be the casting. There's very few casting choices that I can think of off the top of my head that I didn't like. Most of them, I think, were awesome and really captured the characters. And if I had to pick one, I mean, there's so many that I love, but if I had to pick one, I think you all know who I would say. Will Poulter is Eustace. He is Eustace. Like, I cannot think of a better person to portray him, because the way I think he portrayed the character, he just got him. And that's one of the reasons why I can't just throw Don Treader out. I mean, there's lots of reasons why I can't, because there are aspects of that film that I do like, but that is a huge reason. I love his portrayal of Eustace and the way he acted and the way he brought that character to life. Like, I will forever be in love with that. And then the second one would probably be a lot of the cinematography, and this spans, all three of the movies, but, yeah, it's hard for me to pick out specific scenes, but just like the overall effect, I think the cinematography did a great job at capturing the world of Narnia, especially in Prince Caspian. You really get a sense of the scope and the realness and the age, and a lot of that has to do with the way that they did their camera work. And especially since they were working with a lot of real life locations, just being able to capture a lot of that and just make beautiful, it's just beautiful to look at. But also Don Treader has some really nice cinematography as well. And Lion Witch, especially in their battle cinematography, like the Prince Caspian duel, I think there's some good camera work there. And in Lion Witch and the Wardrobe in the battle also.
They definitely got braver with the cinematography between Wardrobe and Caspian. I think with Wardrobe, Andrew Adamson really designed the movie around the limitation of working with children. And he decided... I think he very consciously decided to put some stylistic limitations on himself in the interest of getting good performances out of the kids. For example, lighting very broadly and not planning super specific camera moves, which to get that, Prince Caspian has a lot of very specific camera movement that requires a lot of precision from the actors and the operators and the lighting.
Can you give a quick example, Glenpool? Because you're trained in cinematography. This is your world. So can you give a? Because I'm with you, but I just want to know specifically what you're thinking on.
An example. I mean, even just things like little things like when they're having the argument about which way do we go? Do we go up or down? Did Lucy really see Aslan? And there's just moments of Lucy like turning. She turns and turns right into camera. Where there's a camera waiting to capture her reaction. That's a very little thing, and that's probably, I'm sure I could think of way better examples if I thought about it more. But that's something where when you know you have an experienced actor, and you could say, would you mind saying that line, but kind of lean this way when you say it? And then on take 10, hey, sorry, we didn't quite get you in focus, did a little bit different. Yeah, that's what you do when you have someone you have more trust in as an actor. But Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, you can tell it's lit very broadly, and you can tell that it's shot in a lot of the dialogue is shot in a very traditional soap opera, wide, medium, tight, over the shoulder kind of way. And but what you get in return is simple setups where a child actor can just kind of go anywhere and do almost anything, and it'll probably get covered. So I think that's why we see such great performances at a price, but a price that's totally worth it.
Well, the scene like that I think of when you talk about that is when Lucy goes into Narnia for the first time. And I remember in the behind the scenes, they talked very specifically about how, they made the choice. This is going to be we're not going to do funky lighting. Like, this is going to be daylight. It's, because we want to get her performance, her reaction. So we are going to do everything around that. And does it work? Absolutely. Like, that's such an iconic scene in the whole series.
They actually hid the set from her. I mean, basically brought her on.
Yeah. I mean, the unsung hero of that scene is the Steadicam operator, by the way, who had to follow Georgie around, not knowing where she was going to go. And Steadicams are really heavy. And he had to hold that up for a while and keep her in focus and follow her around and make it look like, yes, it's magical. This is how the shot is planned. But it's totally improvised. Yeah.
And you're both touching on the actors, and I have to say, I'm with you there, because I can't, off the top of my head, I cannot think of a casting choice I was unhappy with. There's a range from good to great to excellent, I think, but I can't think of a that was terrible. I just can't think of one off the top of my head. Maybe there's one if I spent more time thinking about it.
Let's give a shout out to Pier Francisco Favino as Glazel. He's really easy to forget because he has such a minor role in the book. But that he really has probably the most nuanced, maybe one of the most, probably the most nuanced performance out of all the movies. And his character is one of the more, it's a character that doesn't say very much, but Pier Francisco Favino, you can tell there's something going on in there. You can tell he's struggling with things just through his performance without saying very much. He's one of the best characters in the Walden trilogy, despite being very one-dimensional and having very little to do in the book.
Yeah, and Sergio Castellitto as Miraz, which I actually first saw in an Italian film. But it's interesting because I learned in the making of it, he doesn't really speak English. I mean, he speaks some, but he had to read his script in Italian, and then he would learn the lines in English which is interesting. I mean, it really says a lot for his ability as an actor to kind of, I mean, there's no way that not many actors could be like, hey, go ahead and just, we're going to put you in this role speaking Italian, even though you speak English,
right?
You know,
when I interviewed him in Prague on the set, we had to Pier Francisco Favino was actually his translator. He had to translate our questions. Then usually
multi-talented. Cool.
Pier Francisco Favino speaks like four or five languages. I think.
Oh, good grief.
So yeah, so it's, I don't know, some people are just so cool.
We're just dumb Americans.
Dumb American. About to say, you said it.
Well, how about you, Glenpuddle? What are two things that the Walden films just boom nailed it, got right?
Oh, I definitely could go on about the casting a little more. The one I would hold up, single out, is Georgie Henley. And I'm really happy I got to this one. I thought she'd be talked about her a little bit, but that's one of the ones you hear them making the line, The Witch and the Wardrobe, into a movie. And one of the first questions is, who's playing Lucy? And the more I think about it, the more I realize, number one, how horribly wrong the movie would have gone if they hadn't cast the right actors for Lucy.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, what a challenging role it is. It's really hard to not come across as just...
It's a young role.
Yeah, and goody-goody and just very wide-eyed. But really, that's kind of what Lucy is. She is just wide-eyed, and she's just really sincere, and that's kind of it. And I think that could easily come across as really annoying. Like, she's just this little kid who goes, oh, wow, Narnia! And just, you know, I feel like there's not much to her. But
yeah.
Georgie Henley, really, she seems so absolutely sincere. She is what she is, just completely real. And she makes you believe that a little kid would stumble into a magical, for most people, some people struggle to accept this, I know, when they saw the movie. But most everyone, including me, don't struggle to accept that a little kid would stumble across this magical world in the wardrobe and not just, like, run away and go tell someone or something. Like, what's in here? This is scary. Why is there a magical world in the closet? You know, but Georgie Henley makes you believe that she would just go, cool, neato. Or that when she saw a fawn, after the initial fright, she would just go,
right.
Oh, were you hiding from me? Here, let me help you pick up your parcels, and would just go with it. That's a really difficult thing to sell, and Georgie Henley manages to make you believe it because you're so convinced that she believes it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't buy that, then I don't think the movie works. I don't think that you buy Narnia if you don't buy that a little kid would do that. It taps into that sense of the childhood wonderment, childhood kind of naivete. Is that the word? Naivete?
It is a word.
Thank you. I wasn't sure if I got the pronunciation right, but... but yeah, and then I think she also does a really good job at, in Prince Caspian, as the character, kind of evolves and becomes a little more mature. So she gets more of a conflicted, element to that character, but still holding on to that initial, but I just want to believe that Aslan's going to come back, you know? So she does that really well. There's a lot of things I could say about the first 30 minutes of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. It's very well done. And I was thinking, just recently that, we take it for granted, but the fact that there's no dialogue at all when Lucy first discovers Narnia, it'd be very easy to have, wow, what's going on here, or something. And
yeah,
if another director had done it, maybe that's what they would have done. Just had her narrate everything. The scene is very atmospheric and very simple, and they don't try to do too much with it, and they just sort of trust that the power of the scene's going to come through. And then how you just totally believe that this strange fawn creature and Lucy would just hit it off immediately. It doesn't make any sense at all. Wouldn't Lucy get scared? And there's so many reasons why this shouldn't work, and yet you believe it. And so the first 30 minutes of this movie are, Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, are really, really strong, but Georgie Henley is the thing I wanted to really emphasize. So that's number one for me. And then number two, I want to talk about this because, again, it's something that it's not necessarily number two on my list, but it's something that people take for granted. And I appreciate the fact that Narnia is real. And what I mean by that is there's no, the Mrs. MacReady, there's no Wizard of Oz thing where, Mrs. MacReady's the White Witch and the Professor is Tumnus or something like that.
Yes.
There's never even the slightest indication that this is not really happening. And Andrew Adamson, he's talked a little bit about this in the behind the scenes, about when he was mm-hmm. interviewing production designers, and some people were drawing comparisons to Wizard of Oz, the Wizard of Oz, and how, this is a world spawned from a child's imagination. And it would have been really easy to go that direction. And I appreciate the fact that Narnia it's just a real place. And the fact that, you know, as Andrew Adamson puts it, it's an alternative reality, it's a somewhat idealized reality, but it's real, it's physical, it exists. And it's, you know, a lot of our listeners in the Talking Beats Facebook group are highlighting the production design and the visual effects. That's definitely a part of it. The visual effects still hold up very well today. It's hilarious now to see that this movie got beat by King Kong for best visual effects at the Academy Awards.
Which, granted, it's good, but
it has not aged. It's not aged well at the time.
It hasn't.
Yeah, the time the CGI in King Kong looked really impressive. It has not aged well, where the effects in Narnia have. It's still by far the best movie Centaur's ever done. Centaurs have been done a few times since then. There's no comparison. The best movie Centaurs are done.
It was because they did so much of a blend of, you know, well, here's real people with, with, you know, blue screen legs, and here's some fake animals, and then here's some dwarves or small people playing dwarves, you know, that are completely real, and you know, it's all mixed in together.
So it's not just one trick that once you figure it out, I get it, this is what they're doing. They keep mixing it up, and I think that's a big part of it. Tumnus's legs, what an accomplishment. I remember I'd been we'd all been following this movie for a while. I'd been following it for three or four years by the time I saw it in theaters. And I remember hearing they're going to, the Tumnus's legs were going to be CGI. And I went, how the heck is that going to work? And I didn't even think about it until the second or third scene with Tumnus. I just went, yeah, he's got goat legs. Why not? I didn't even question it until like the scene later. I was totally just drawn into the story and drawn into the performance, which of course is the best compliment you give visual effects is I forgot they were effects and I was just focused on the story. So those are definitely two things that I would highlight. I hope we have time for a really quick lightning round at the end where we can just boom, 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 go through some other things that didn't quite make the cut. But yeah, those are two things I really love about the Walden and Narnie movies.
Yeah, we can do a lightning round at the end. I have to, and I mean, I'm not saying that these are maybe the two biggest things, because I think I have to really focus on a lot of the things you guys have said, like the actors. I mean, if the actors, especially the Pevensey children, if they had just been mediocre, you know, not even good, just mediocre, then the film would have failed. But I'm going to focus on two things. One is the set design, and the Lord of the Rings spoiled us. Really spoiled us. People hadn't done chainmail like that in movies. I mean, you go back to some older movies in the 90s, you know, just the decade before. And I just watched the trailer for the new Robin Hood movie, and the clothing is so modern. I mean, it looks like stuff you could buy at Gap, you know, and it would have been. And so on one hand, we came off of it. Well, I mean, of course it's supposed to be handmade armor that actually would work. You know, it's easy to, because of course, you know, you have Weta Workshop working on it. But it really was so impressive, and it lent so much realism. But just this, the props and the sets, I liked. I mean, Prince Caspian had an appropriately different feel from Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and at the same time, but both seemed just as real to me as I'm watching. I mean, Lion, the Witch, and Wardrobe maybe had some more green screen, blue screen stuff for some of the backgrounds and things, but both really, especially when you get to Aslan's camp, you think, oh, this is just real. It's old. It's authentic. And the Voyage of the Dawn Treader. I love the Dawn Treader. I still think it's a fantastic design for the ship. It's not, I mean, it's beautiful, but it looks functional and real. And so I think that there are some things, and again, other movies, not so much the first two Harry Potter films, but the later Harry Potter films kind of spoiled us around the same time too, with I think some good set design and stuff. But it's easy. You have to kind of keep a long view of how fantasy films have been done. I mean, it wasn't too long before Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe that Dungeons & Dragons came out. Just a super cheap-looking film. And there's a lot of sword and fantasy films that have been done, and they just look awful, the vast majority of them. And so I have to give a kudos to Richard Taylor and all of his hardworking people at Weta, because that, I was not disappointed there at all.
And Roger Ford, the production designer, and Howard Berger, who got the Academy Award for makeup for Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, of course.
The makeup was huge.
Great. Yeah. And I love that they used makeup. I love that they actually had animatronics, masks, and things. And
yeah, I remember how surprised we were when the first behind-the-scenes video came out and seeing so many real... remember seeing the real Cyclops blink and the real Minotaurs walking around. We were really surprised at how many real things there were, and it totally pays off.
It definitely does. And the second thing I really have to give a shout out to, I have to give a shout out to Harry Gregson-Williams for his score on the first two films. I just loved it. I thought it was so well done. There were points where it's very rousing, but it's also, it works well in the background too, where like when Lucy's going into Narnia for the first time. It's a great song, but you're not thinking about the great song. You're thinking about Lucy going into Narnia, which is the way it should work. And I still listen to the scores. I mean, they're really well done. And I think that Harry Gregson Williams is one of the better composers out there today. And I mean, there's a reason that a lot of people mention it in the comments, because it's, I think they're both really good scores. And it's not just like one song that stands out in the whole, in either soundtrack. There's good music throughout. And I thought it was Narnian, and I thought it was amazing.
Yeah, I think my favorite piece by Harry Gregson Williams, I think, is Lucy, when Lucy and Tumnus first meet.
Yeah, that's a good one.
There's this sense of reluctance and like, I'm not sure who you are. It's warm and tender, but it also has this sense of uncertainty. It's definitely, that's probably my favorite piece out of all the movies.
I think the music that they have for the Narnia films is very iconic. And I say that, and I understand that, like, if people who haven't really watched the movies, if they listen to the music, they probably wouldn't be able to place it. But for people who do watch the movies, you can see the themes that are woven through all three films, and how it's just, it's very put together, and there's just, you know, you have these moments where if you like, if you tell me the name of a scene, I could probably start humming you the music that was in that scene, depending on which one it was. But, you know, like, there's certain things where it's just like,
Edmund in the dungeon, give me right now, Edmund in the dungeon, hum it right now.
I'll pass.
Never mind. Sorry. I won't do that to you. that was not the stump question. Don't worry.
Oh, good. No, we already know the stump question. And the problem is I've been thinking about this whole time.
Oh, you got an excuse. Okay.
Yeah, no, it's just different, like, pieces. I listened to the Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe soundtrack to death over the years. Prince Caspian as well. And then with Don Treader, like, they got a new composer, but they still kept certain themes. And there's certain parts in that film as well that are just, like, so beautiful, and I just love it, and it's just amazing.
The end of the world scene was well done.
And then in the very last scene, there's some really quiet, toned down music that's very nice.
Yeah, like the transition into Narnia.
That's a fun scene, when the picture in the bedroom scene, the transition in there is.
Yep.
Yeah.
That was one of the better scenes, I thought, that was adapted. It'd be easy to get that wrong.
Uh huh.
And I thought that did it, because it looked very cartoonish.
Uh-huh.
Almost like an old 1970s world movie.
If you tried to do it exactly as described in the book, it probably, where it's, you know, they get smaller and they're standing on the edge of the frame, kind of like in the Pauline Baynes illustration, it probably would look very cartoonish. So I think the fact that they went for something a little more physical, like the water filling up the room, that was probably the way to do it. And then at the end, when the water is sort of draining out and their clothes are dry, which they did by filming backwards, that was really effective. Yeah.
So, okay, before we wrap up our favorite stuff, shotgun it. What are just some things that you wanted to say, but, like, you want, because there's a lot more than two.
Oh, here we go.
We can
okay.
go on for forever.
Okay, so some things.
Glumbuddle's going to go. Everybody get ready.
This is mine. So some things that didn't quite make my list. All right, see how fast I can do this. So the carvings in Prince Caspian, when they discover it's Aslan's How, that scene is, again, almost no dialogue. It captures all the themes of Prince Caspian, the weirdness of these myths and legends returning from the past, and oh my gosh, now they're carvings on a wall. I love that scene, love that reveal. Eddie, we talked about casting a lot. Eddie Izzard is Reepy Cheep. In fact, just about everything about Reepy Cheep in the Prince Caspian movie, I really, really like. That was awesome. I know they were some mixed feelings about Eddie Izzard when he was first cast, and I was on board immediately, and I remain on board. Tilda Swinton is the White Witch. I love the blonde hair, and everyone does. I do, and I loved her toned down, in control, kind of quiet performance. Totally different from Barbara Kellerman in the BBC versions. Father Christmas.
Yeah.
Father Christmas, that whole scene could have been just terrible. It could have having Santa Claus suddenly show up could have derailed the whole movie. It's my number one. It's either my favorite scene or second favorite scene in Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. It could have been a horrible, cheesy scene, man. They just nail it so well. The statues scene in the White Witch's courtyard. Let's pause for a minute and just focus on the creepiness and the atmosphere. So effective, and it turns the witches. It's just like he's setting off that time bomb with the quietness, and then it explodes when the witch finally, loses her temper. Lucy's Dream and Prince Caspian. I know it's not in the book. Not everybody likes it. I think it was an example of great adaptation and translating some of the themes of the book visually into reflected in the color palette of the film and captured very well. I love the ending of the Night Raid. It's just heartbreaking. Yes, I like the design of the Dawn Treader. The scene where Peter stabs that Minotaur and starts running towards the White Witch. That's really, and how all the sound, great sound mixing. They got an Academy Award nomination for that. Where all the sound, all
and
he
the
hears,
score in that moment is awesome.
Yeah,
it's a knockout.
All he hears is Edmund hitting the ground, and I have two younger brothers, and that scene always gets me. That's probably one of the most emotional moments in all the movies. And I also appreciate what the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe finally is not, because in the early 90s there were attempts to get this movie made. Actually, Kathleen Kennedy was involved in trying to do a modern take on the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I don't know if the whole thing of the doing cheeseburgers instead of Turkish Delight, I don't know if that was actually true. I never heard good confirmation on that.
I heard pizza.
There was an attempt to set it in modern times, and that's where Gresham just went, nope. And Gresham also felt the technology wasn't ready, so waited another decade and a half or so. I'm really glad that they stuck with the World War II setting. So I could go on with more things, but there's my lightning. Yeah, there's a handful off the top of my
head. I can't compete with this. I don't know what to say. I thought I would have something. I have nothing after that.
How about you, Jim Fan?
I would say the end credits for Dawn Treader, all the Pauline Baynes illustrations.
Yes.
The made for movie awesome. Songs in Prince Caspian and also Dawn Treader. I like those songs, especially at the end of Prince Caspian when they actually put the song into the film. I thought it was very appropriate. I liked it. What else? The costumes. I love the costumes, especially in Prince Caspian.
Love Lucy's dress in Prince Caspian.
Yes. Creature design. I thought they did a great job with that, like the Minotaurs, the Centaurs. They just did a great job bringing them to life and using new or alternative methods to make it work, like putting them on those little bungee stilt things, like who'd have thunk, but it worked. It really worked. James McAvoy as Tumnus, I love that.
That was a controversial choice because he was so young, but it worked out.
It worked. And I know why they did it. And I think that was 100% the right choice, because when you look back on this movie, like, it holds up. Like, you don't look and be like, wow, that was a very dated casting choice, or that yes. acting choice, or that directing choice. That just, like, it really dates it. Like, I go back and I see some things about the movies, and there are certain things that do date it a little bit, but that is not one of them. They just made very fresh choices, and they did good choices, and they followed through, especially with their casting. And I loved James McAvoy's performance. I like the last scene in Dawn Treader, the whole transition back into the real world. Just that whole ending, I thought that was a very appropriate ending for the trilogy. And it redeems a whole lot of that movie for me, because I love it. I think it worked out really well, and it was just very emotional and very on point for me.
Jill Pohl has dropped in for a visit. Or not. We'll see.
We'll see. I just echo Tilda Swinton. I thought she did a fantastic job, and I loved the design that they did for her with, like, her whole ice crown, and then how it kind of melts, and then eventually she abandons it and she just goes for something totally different. They just thought through so much of that so well. And I do love Andrew Adamson and his directing choices, and I know not everything people have agreed with, but for me personally, I really loved that he had a vision, and it was his vision. And he stuck with it, and he made it a reality. And he didn't he didn't let too many things just kind of push him and pull him and sway him in like 50 million directions. Like, he knew what he wanted and he stuck with it. So that way what you end up getting is fairly coherent. Like, it works together. Like, maybe it's not quite the direction that you wanted it to go in, but as a whole, it works. And this, I feel this especially for Prince Caspian, because he had his vision and, you know, from point A to point Z, he saw it through to completion. And for me, I think it works as a film. So
yeah, actually, I remember there was a negative review for Prince Caspian. And actually what it said was a review for Don Treader. And it said, Prince Caspian may have been a step in the wrong direction for this franchise, but at least it took that step confidently. And that was even a negative reviewer recognizing that this isn't just, in large part, in some ways it is, but this isn't just, you know, a Hollywood machine making this. There is someone at the center of it trying to tell a coherent story.
Yeah, and I always appreciated that. And I think that goes so far in just being able to, like, when you understand that there is someone behind there who cares so passionately about what he's doing, then it helps give you perspective about how he made those choices, why he made those choices. And it works. I think it works. So,
yeah, I'll say Andrew Adamson, we could talk about, does he really understand and appreciate the aspects of the book? I think he should. We could talk about that. Maybe not. But I'll say this. I think you can tell watching the movies that he really, really likes them. I think you can absolutely feel it. How much he enjoys the stories when you look at his adaptations.
I think you could also say he not just likes and enjoys it, but he respects the stories. I think he respects the stories as their own entities. And I could come up with like a whole list like you guys did, but I just feel like I have to do one big point of emphasis. Peter Dinklage.
Boom. Oh, yes. How could I forget?
Man, I just love that guy. That was so cool having him in the movie, but that's a good list, guys. I really can't. I mean,
well, I'm sure people in the comments, can point out all the things that we missed.
All the things we missed.
All right, Jim Fan, you've told us all the things you like about these movies, but how much do you really know about them? I wonder.
10 years ago.
Let's dump a Narnia Weber.
If you're listening to this, Shane, I apologize. 10 years ago, I probably could have done this extremely well. I'm very rusty now.
Are you worthy of being his Facebook friend?
Probably not.
It's on the line right here. You could get unfriended. all right. The question one more time. In the Chronicles of Narnia movies, stuntman Shane Rainey is credited with 4 roles. Can you name them all? And Jim Penny can ask for a hint if you want. Because he played so many, but he was only credited with 4.
So I can tell you the creatures, but I don't know the character names.
I will accept that.
Okay. So, and I hope I have this right. Oh my goodness. So he's the Minotaur guy. So that was kind of his thing. Okay, so I know Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe. He's the general. In Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, he also was a centaur, but I don't know if that was credited or not. So that's 2. And then in Prince Caspian, I believe he was the Minotaur again. And didn't he do puppet work for Aslan? But I don't know if that was credited.
When I interviewed him on the set in Prague, he I remember someone asking him, I remember him saying he thought he was as many as 5 or 6 characters in Prince Caspian, and someone said, so are you ever in a scene with yourself? And he just went, oh, I don't know. I'm honestly not sure. So that guy gets around.
Yeah, definitely. I'm pretty sure he's also in Don Treader, but I don't remember the exact thing. Okay, I'll take your hint.
You're gonna blow Queen Susan's horn and ask for a hint. Your hint. Well, in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, he did not receive credit as the centaur blowing the horn at Aslan's camp. And also in Prince Caspian, one of his credited roles was the werewolf.
Oh, okay.
So you can cross one of those off your list and add another.
He does so much of the creature work. I just don't remember the exact ones, so I'm going to have to go with that, the ones that I know.
Okay, so we'll go ahead. Would you mind listing the four for me? We already know about the werewolf and Prince Caspian, so I'll go ahead and do that one. And then what are the other three?
The Minotaur and Wardrobe, and also in Prince Caspian.
All right, those are three. We need a fourth.
I'll say a Minotaur and Don Treader. I don't remember for sure, but maybe.
Okay, maybe so not. Then. Okay, the correct answer, Shane Rainey's four roles, are in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Yes, the Minotaur General, whose name is Otman. In Prince Caspian, he played another Minotaur named Asterius. Also, in Prince Caspian, of course, he was the werewolf as well. And finally, in Don Treader, he was a Minotaur!
You
got it! The Minotaur's name was Tavros.
I remember there was a Minotaur because it was like this big thing. People were like, there's a Minotaur on the Don Treader.
That was an issue, I remember, having Minotaurs on the Don Treader.
But we're like, it's Shane. Like, how can you not have Shane in the movies? Kind of like a staple.
Are we done talking about Narnia then?
And now it's time for something else. The part of the show where Narnia Webbers talk about something else.
Well, the reason why I was gone the last few episodes was because I was traveling. And I know that the rest of us have also traveled, been to fun places.
How many countries did you travel to this time?
This time? Five.
Okay.
Just five.
Only five.
You don't get though. Like in Europe, you can hit five countries in like one day if you're in the right spot. It's not that impressive.
That's true. Were you just doing this for fun?
Yeah, I was visiting a friend.
Okay.
A friend in five countries.
A friend in one country, and then we traveled around. But yeah. Anyway, I know that you guys have also traveled. I think traveling is awesome. I think it's one of the best gifts you can ever give yourself. For various reasons, but it is great to be able to get out and see more of the world and meet different people and have new experiences. And so my question is, what is your favorite place that you've ever traveled to and why?
Well, this is going to kind of go back to, and a lot of people already know this, but I got to study for a term abroad in Oxford, England, and at New College, actually. And Oxford is a truly magical city. It's very different from Cambridge. From my understanding, if you go to Cambridge, then the university is kind of set apart from the town of Cambridge. But the city of Oxford and the University of Oxford are completely intertwined. You'll walk out of Trinity College and into a Blackwell's bookstore, or you'll walk into a pub next to Christchurch, and it's just amazing. It's gorgeous. Some of the best conversations and some of the best closest friends I've ever had in my life I met in Oxford, and it kind of explains so much. I mean, you just walk through, and this goes for a lot of the UK or I suppose Ireland, but you look at the trees and you say, oh, this is why these men wrote books about trees that could talk. Just the type of people there, they're very interesting people. A lot of times they're kind of on a different, I don't know, it's just interesting because there's a lot of very clever, bright students at these universities. And it was just really, really weird. Playing charades, and two of the items in the charades game were perestroika and laissez-faire economy, and and they figured it out on these teams. But Yeah, if anyone's ever in the UK, Oxford's about maybe an hour, 20 minutes by coach outside of London. Just go. Go. It's amazing. I'm hoping to go back very soon, and I can't wait. I was there for 4 months, and then about 2.5, well, I guess it was like 2.5, 3 months.
You did one of your, you did a YouTube video from The Eagle and Child, right? Where Lewis, Tolkien, and the other Inklings would meet up.
Yes, I did. And I was in the Rabbit Room, which The Eagle and Child has actually expanded quite a bit. It's about twice the size as it was in Lewis and Tolkien's day. And if you ever go, few people know this, there's a second Inklings pub. The Eagle and Child was the one that they were at for the longest time, but then the owner changed the wallpaper without asking their permission. So the story goes. So they walked across the street to the Lamb and Flag, which I actually think has better food and a better atmosphere. I actually like the Lamb and Flag a little bit.
Not a sponsor. Not a sponsor.
Not a sponsor. No.
So for me, I think I'm not, I mean, what you said, Jim Fan, about traveling, great. I personally, give me a couple thousand dollars to spend on a date with my wife. Probably order lots of pizza and stay home. maybe get a bigger TV or something and watch a movie with her. I'm an introvert, and I visited Germany, and for my honeymoon I went to Oregon, just because we'd never been there, and we went to the Redwoods Park and just kind of explored. My wife really likes national parks, and that was really fun. I'm glad I've done that, but that's not my happy place. That's something to do just to like say I've done it, maybe meet some people or whatever, but it just tires me out, I guess. I don't know. I just don't have the stamina, I guess, to travel. It just takes so much out of me. The best trip I've taken, I'll come as no surprise, probably anyone here, I've talked about it at great length, is Narnia. The set of Prince Caspian, when they were filming Prince Caspian in Prague, went there to write reports for Narnia Web. And I mean, Prague was pretty cool, whatever, but it was the Narnia set, and the chance to just see a real movie set and see him bringing my favorite book to life. I mean, what could possibly compare to that?
Interviewing everybody. Thing. Cool.
And another thing, I used to do a lot of work for Disney World, a lot of video production work. And there was a time when I was at Disney World at like 2 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, I associate Disney World with noise, crowds, you know, it's just packed and there's so much going on. It's hot, it's sweaty, and the music and the people and blah, blah, blah.
Children.
And I, yeah, that too. And I got to see Disney World when it was just serenity. Just, I mean, like not even really that many lights were on. So I remember,
because no one's there.
So where the spot. It was, well, there were some workers there, but it's 2 o'clock in the morning. It's totally closed. I was there to get ready to film something that they were going to do at like 6 or 7 in the morning.
So basically, if you could have Disney World all to yourself, you're happy.
Yeah.
I remember thinking, man, if the shoot gets canceled, that'd be awesome. I'm just like, all right, I'm going on Splash Mountain, but Splash Mountain was turned off. but just that feeling of that place that I associate with, crowds and craziness and activity, just being completely deadly silent and peaceful. I don't know if that sounds, may not sound that amazing, but that's one of the most amazing moments of my life, I feel like.
Totally does, because I used to go to Disneyland a lot, and one of my favorite memories of Disneyland was one night when it was raining and I went into the Pirates of the Caribbean ride, and when I came out, I just walked into this little alley and there was no one there. Just a little bit of rain pattering down, quiet and peaceful and still. And it's just, it's magical. It really is.
Jim Fan, we got to hurry it up here. I've been going for a while. But so can you limit yours to like 10 favorite places?
10 favorite places. Okay, I'll stick to one. I lived in Taiwan for 3 years. I absolutely love it. Just everywhere in the country is amazing. But my favorite place that I went to in Taiwan was a little island that was off the coast of the city where I lived. And it's called Green Island, and it's called that because it's green. It's like this little rocky out tiny thing, and it's just got hills that are just covered in green grass and just the most amazing blue ocean. And my friend and I, we biked around, and It's just, it looks like something that you see in a magic, you know, like a kid's storybook. Like, it just, it doesn't look real, but it is real. And it's just super beautiful. And we went snorkeling and saw all the rainbow fish, and it was really fun. And it's just one of the most beautiful places I've ever been to.
Well, Jim Fan, you've completely sold me, Jim Fan. Like, as soon as your check arrives in the mail, I'm going. I'm totally going.
I'll work on that.
Now, you've done some amazing things, Jim Fan, but been to amazing places, but have any of them been so amazing as reading the outro on Talking Beasts?
Not yet.
Want to give it a whirl?
I can. We can see how many takes it's going to take me.
Nope, you get one take. That's the deal.
And if you screw up, just go, I'll start over. And yeah.
Okay, Jim Fan's first time doing the outro.
No, you've done it before.
All right.
Is this your first time?
Yes. Yep, it is. We tried to talk her into it last time. She was like, nope.
All right. You've been listening to Talking Beasts, a NarniaWeb.com podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider sharing it with a friend. And be sure to subscribe and post a comment below or in the Talking Beasts Facebook group. You can also email us at podcast@narniaweb.com, rillian@narniaweb.com, jimfan15@narniaweb.com, or glumpuddle@narniaweb.com. Special thanks to the rest of our podcast team, AJ Aiken, Ryidian, and the Rose Tree Dryad. For the latest news on the Silverchair movie, or Netflix, or whatever the heck it's going to be, visit narniaweb.com. This fall, a new episode of Talking Beasts is posted on the 7th and 17th of every month. We'll be back on October 17th. Until then, further up and further in.